In 1961, a thief broke into the National Gallery in London and committed the most sensational art heist in British history. He stole the museum's much-prized painting, The Duke of Wellington, by Francisco Goya. Despite unprecedented international attention and an unflagging investigation, the case was not solved for 4 years, and even then only because the culprit came forward voluntarily. But how true was the truth? Over 50 years later, Alan Hirsch decided to explore the facts behind the historic case and uncovered shocking new evidence that both solved the crime and deepened the mystery. Alan Hirsch's new book is The Duke of Wellington Kidnapped, the incredible true story of the art heist that shocked a nation. Hirsch is a writer and chair of the Justice and Law Studies program at Williams College. He moonlights as a trial consultant and expert witness on police interrogations and false confessions across the nation. Again, the name of the book is The Duke of Wellington Kidnapped, and we welcome Alan Hirsch to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure to be on.
What brought you to the subject? Why did you want to write about this particular art heist?
So there's sort of a general answer and a specific answer. The general one is I am by training an attorney and an art historian, and I moonlight as an expert in false confessions. So this was a case which involved the theft of a famous work of art by the master Goya, which led to a courtroom drama, a trial like no other I've ever seen or been part of, producing a verdict that's unique, which actually caused Great Britain to change its criminal justice laws, and that had at its heart what looked to me to be a false confession. So it was an almost remarkable intersection of all my professional interests. The more specific answer is the genesis of the book is April 26th, 2009. And I only remember that with such precision because I'm a baseball fan. And that night, Jacoby Ellsbury, then with the Red Sox, stole home plate at Fenway Park. But earlier that day, I was having a conversation about art crime with Noah Charney, who's probably the world's leading authority on art crime. And he knew more about this story than I did, but we were kicking it around and agreed that it was one of the more bizarre art thefts ever. And the more I heard about it, the more I thought it's too good to be true and I have to look into it. And then as I looked into it, it turned out to be even more bizarre than I had imagined.
So let's start with the baseline. 1961, a thief breaks into the National Gallery in London and steals a much-prized painting in the museum's collection. That is The Duke of Wellington by Francis Goya. Obviously, this gets great international attention. There is an intense investigation, but it takes 4 years for the crime to be solved, and even then only because the culprit comes forward voluntarily. So, what led to that extraordinary moment 4 years after the heist that a gentleman comes forward and says, I did it?
Okay, so we have to back up. This story, exactly as you say, seized the imagination of the world, but certainly Great Britain, so much so that the next year in the first James Bond movie, Dr. No, the painting turns up in the Caribbean lair of the villain, and Sean Connery's James Bond does this triple take. The crime was solved in fiction, but in real life, for the next 4 years, there were these periodic ransom notes. Odd as that may seem, the person who had apparently taken the painting was from time to time sending notes to various British newspapers seeking to gain money for charity, or so he says. But the authorities were not at liberty because of British law to negotiate with him. So the 4 years come and go. And then in March of 1965, the Daily Mirror, a tabloid that was brash and looking for attention, decided to get into the act. And they sort of published, they initiated a kind of de facto negotiation with the thief, which resulted in May of 1965 in the painting being anonymously returned by someone calling himself Mr. Bloxham, which is curious in its own right. And then 2 months later, someone walks into Scotland Yard's office and says, I'm here to for the Goya. And the authorities naturally start pumping him for information. And curiously, he says, look, I don't want to tell you about it unless you arrest me. You ready to charge me? Then I'll talk. And of course, that merely enhanced their suspicions that maybe he wasn't the culprit after all, suspicions that never completely went away, although this man did go to trial several months later. And the trial, as I say, is about as wacky as it gets.
This guy is kind of as wacky as it gets, right? It's Kempton Bunton. He is an older gentleman. Here's what we know. He says he used a toy gun. He purchased a disguise with very little money and kind of gets the getaway car from a drunk guy in the street. So there you go.
He has a pretty odd story. And at the heart of the story is a sort of physical oddity, which is how did this 57 years old at the time of the theft, large man, manage what the judge in the trial repeatedly called a remarkable athletic feat of transporting this painting. By the way, the first painting ever stolen, the only theft in the history of the London National Gallery, 137 years, a very sophisticated system for protection of art. And he managed to get it down 14 feet, a fairly heavy frame. So how did he do it? Could he possibly have done it alone? And then, as you say, some of his individual details strained the imagination. So a lot of these things strained the imagination. And yet, when he went to trial, one of the few things that the prosecution and the defense agreed on, even though the judge expressed some doubts, was that Bunton was the thief.
What he started to say during the trial was that, yes, there was a confession, and he did not allege that the confession was false, but he did say that stealing the painting did not constitute a crime because he intended to return it.
Which sounds like one of the most ingenious or else incredible, in the literal sense of not credible, defenses in the history of the criminal justice system. But there was a loophole in the British larceny law such that it does appear that there was such a thing that we might call legal borrowing. Unless you actually intended to, and now this is direct language from the statute, permanently deprive the owner of his property, you were not guilty of larceny. So this was the ingenious defense that Kempton Bunton fairly quickly came across. It was his idea, not his lawyer's originally. He said, look, I took the painting, but I always intended to return it. And I did return it. Although I should add, because this ends up being an important wrinkle, he returned it without the frame. But he did return the painting, and he said, therefore, this was essentially a legal borrowing.
Do we know what he did with the painting from the time he took it to the time he returned it without the frame?
Well, first, let's be careful about saying he took it. But we do know that the painting was, for a period of years, taken very good care of by him, packaged very carefully, kept in his Newcastle home. And one of the many odd things about this case is that he was able to preserve the painting intact through quite a lot of traveling.
So, and I leave this up to you as to how much you want to tell about this story, not to give away the book. But by the same token, so in being careful of not saying the word that he took it, but is it safe to say that he knew what happened?
It's kind of you to invite me to be coy about that. You know, this book, unlike anything else I've ever written, puts me in the unusual position of not wanting to say too much because there are a lot of twists and turns,
yeah,
and suspense is a part of it. So let's say that it is safe to say that Kempton Bunton knew the whereabouts of the painting through the period from 1961 to 1965, and I'd rather let readers discover the rest.
What makes the case so unusual, and I guess to the most important part, that so that this law would not be used again and to prevent future people from walking into museums, taking paintings and saying, oh, I was borrowing them, I'm going to bring them back?
Right. So at the heart of that is this loophole in the larceny law, which enabled someone to argue that they were guilty or not guilty because they engaged in a legal borrowing. So that got closed, and in fact, a whole other law was added, which made it illegal to take an object that is on public view. This could have been called the Kempton Bunton Law. This was a case of Parliament meeting and explicitly saying, you know, we have to deal with this weird case that arose. But in terms of what makes the case odd, it was much more than that. I mean, during the trial, someone came forward with information that was crucial, that could have upended the trial. And it did, in fact, cause a kind of panicky recess. But neither the defense nor the prosecution wanted to pursue this new evidence for reasons that are weird in themselves. The judge put his thumb on the scales of justice in his charge to the jury. He kind of let on that he had doubts about the story that even the defense and prosecution had agreed on. There's more. The defense raised the issue that maybe the painting was a fake, which was clearly irrelevant because it's illegal to steal a fake just as much as to steal an authentic object, and there was no real evidence that this was not a Goya, but the defense was trying odd things. The prosecution was doing strange things. So really, from start to finish, this was as unusual a trial as I've ever seen. And of course, as you know, the trial doesn't end everything.
No, it doesn't end everything. And what does that say about the system of justice? And I also want to obviously focus on what is your expertise, and that is the confession, which I'm sure had, as you write, had a lot to do with the trial itself.
Right. So false confessions are really surprisingly frequent. And when I testify about that phenomenon around the country, I'm typically talking about confessions that we call coerced, that come about because law enforcement uses interrogation tactics that unfortunately work too well. They can break down the innocent as well as the guilty. But there is also this phenomenon called the voluntary false confession, which is staggeringly frequent as well. So when this is someone that comes forward absent any interrogative setting, and for one reason or another, and there are various motives we find, takes credit or blame for some crime that he did not commit. Classic example, in the Lindbergh case, more than 200 people, when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped, claimed to have done the deed. In this case, we had, as you indicated at the very outset, someone who came in. They were not on the verge of getting him, and he said, I took the painting. And if I call it a voluntary false confession, we'll know that he didn't. So let's just say that it was a confession that had indicia of non-reliability, to use a kind of unsexy technical term, but a confession that there was some reason to doubt. But as I've indicated, the only person who doubted it was the judge. The prosecution said this is the guy who did it. The defense said this is the guy who did it, but he's not guilty because he intended to return it. And the judge said, wow, this remarkable athletic feat, I'm not so sure this guy could have done it, or certainly maybe didn't do it alone.
And that athletic feat is going through a bathroom window to get into the museum. Also, he's a big guy, and he's partially disabled?
Yes, and the tricky part is getting out of the museum
right.
with the painting, and it was 14 feet to the ground from the lavatory window where it was pretty clear the thief had come. So there was reason to think that there was more than one thief. But there's more to this story. This happened to be 50 years to the day that the Mona Lisa was stolen from the Louvre. And so that seems improbable that that would be a coincidence. So could this have been a prankster? So when Scotland Yard is taking on this case in the early days, they're thinking, number one, this looks like a professional job. It looks like it took more than one person. It very well was done by people who were knowledgeable in art history and were pranksters of some kind or other. And without going into detail about it, I would say that just about all of their assumptions turned out to be mistaken.
As far as that idea of someone helping him and having an accomplice, who could that have been? He was a bit of a drifter. So who was close enough to him to have helped in some way, shape, or form?
Well, I don't want to get too much into that. I will say that that subject was an obsession of the prosecutor at trial in yet another of the oddities of the trial. When Kempton Bunton was cross-examined, the prosecutor's main job should have been to prove that he intended to take the painting because their defense, or to keep the painting, because the defense was that he did not intend to keep the painting. But instead, the prosecutor asked him more than anything else about his accomplice. He kept grilling him. Who did you tell anyone? Did you know anyone? And Kempton Bunton always insisted that he acted solo.
So let's flash ahead here and go to 1996. The National Gallery releases a statement and suggests that Bunton may have been innocent. So what led to the decision to issue that statement?
Well, it turns out I'm not actually sure that such a statement was issued. It's long been believed that it was, but I was never able to find such a statement. What I was able to find, and why I think it's reported that there was a statement, is that in 1996, the file on the case was opened. I think there's a law in Britain that files stay sealed for 30 years. So now the National Gallery file gets open, and you see in that letters from people who were to some extent in the know saying, you know, I don't think Kempton Bunton did it. And that gets reported as there's reason to think Kempton Bunton is innocent, and before you know it, the rumor mill is churning. But oddly enough, the rumor mill then closes, and everyone goes back to assuming he was guilty. But I can, if you want, elaborate on what the basis was for thinking he might have been innocent.
Okay.
So one thing that happens is 4 years later, in 1969, someone else comes forward and confesses. Says it wasn't Kempton Bunton, it was me. This is someone who was apprehended for an unrelated crime and then says, oh, and by the way, I'm the guy who took the Goya too. And Kempton Bunton is naturally contacted, and he says, it's true, I'm innocent. And I was able to get my hands on the Department of Public Prosecution's files, their in-depth files about what happened, their investigation into this new confession in 1969. And that is among the items that's suspenseful in the book, so I won't go in the weeds there. But I will say that they investigated it, and they concluded that probably the new confessor was in fact guilty. Probably Bunton was innocent. But nevertheless, for various complicated reasons, we're going to sweep this under the rug and not pursue it. And oddly, the media, which reported the new confession somewhat eagerly, did not follow up. The story just fades away. And then for the next several, so Kempton Bunton dies 8 years later, and the eulogies say that he was the convicted felon, and everybody believes that more or less for several decades.
I'm curious about the statement in 1996 and the question marks surrounding that. Given that it is rather contemporary, it seems that that would be an easy phone call to the museum and say, hey, by the way, was there a statement ever put out? How did this get to be widely disseminated? And also, what is it about the museum that seems to be, at least in my reading of it, a little cagey in the whole thing?
Yeah, I think everybody was a little cagey in the whole thing. And it has to do with the fact that the theft was an embarrassment. And then if it turns out that the theft was an embarrassment, the investigation was an embarrassment. 4 years of cat and mouse games with the thief, and he's never caught. He has to turn himself in. Then you've got this trial, and if that produces an incorrect verdict, if they get the wrong guy, that's an embarrassment. So I think that an awful lot of what you're getting at is things got swept under the rug out of embarrassment.
But it's also safe to say that after 50 years, a lot of the people that were there then are not there now. So isn't there an obligation and even a want and a need to clarify things?
Maybe not. But I tried to do that for them. I tried to tell the full story in this book.
Were they helpful in that regard?
Well, I think, as you say, a lot of the people who were cagey along the way are no longer with us. The people who I talked to who were participants in the trial were definitely helpful. But these were people who did not have a motive to cover anything up. I think what you're getting at, I think the story is somewhat disturbing in terms of the behavior of law enforcement at different points along the way. But I'd be slow to condemn them too much. It's such a weird case. And there were times where people didn't know what to do for reasons that were innocent. And the perfect example, I mentioned that someone comes forward in the middle of the trial with information that really cast doubt upon Kempton Bunton's guilt. And you'd say, what's going on? Why wasn't that evidence given to the jury? Well, for reasons that emerge in the book, no one wanted it to be, understandably. Everybody had good reasons, even though those reasons differed, for not opening that can of worms. So again, I think this case is sui generis. I would be careful about condemning, you know, the criminal justice system over some of the weird things that happened here.
So with all of that said, and without giving anything away in the book, and I understand the necessity to do that, But with all of that said, is it safe for you to say that we still really don't know what happened?
I think we more or less do know, although the book closes on a really quirky note of uncertainty.
Yeah.
So one thing I talk about in the conclusion, which I label non-conclusion, is that in almost every case I'm associated with and every involved case that gets studied, something doesn't quite fit. And I give the O.J. Simpson trial as an example. You know, I think people have pretty much settled on his guilt, and yet there is the question of what was the why the glove didn't fit and Mark Furman's ability to plant it and so forth. So it's the awkwardness of experience is such that no case fits together perfectly. When this case is concerned, I feel that now just about all of it fits together perfectly, except for one important detail that I've been unable to find a good explanation for it, but I offer a few maybe acceptable explanations at the end.
Is the book sold in the National Gallery gift shop?
I honestly don't know.
That would tell us a lot, wouldn't it?
That would be interesting to find out.
All right, well, we'll make a phone call and see. The name of the book is The Duke of Wellington Kidnapped, the incredible true story of the art heist that shocked a nation, and it's still on display. We can see the painting.
Yes, the painting is back in the gallery, and I got to see it a few years ago. A terrific painting.
It's The Duke of Wellington Kidnapped, the incredible true story of the art heist that shocked a nation. Alan Hirsch, thank you very much for spending time with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you very much.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.